Welcome to the Long Thread Podcast about spinning, stitching, and weaving by hand. The podcast is presented by Long Thread Media, publishers of Spinoff, Handwoven, Piecework, and Little Looms magazines. Find us online at longthreadmedia.com. This episode is sponsored by handweaving.net, the comprehensive weaving website with more than 75,000 historic and modern weaving drafts, documents, and powerful digital tools that put creativity in your hands. Now it's simple to design, color, update, and save your drafts. Handweaving.net's mission is to preserve the rich heritage of handweaving and pass it down to you. Visit handweaving.net and sign up for a subscription today. This episode is sponsored by Trainway Silks. You'll find the largest variety of silk spinning fibers, silk yarn, and silk threads and ribbons at trainwaysilks.com. Choose from a rainbow of hand-dyed colors. Love natural? Their array of wild silk and silk blends provide choices beyond white. Trainway Silks, where superior quality and customer service are guaranteed. I'm your host, Long Thread Media co-founder, Anne Merrow. Chris Bruland is a weaver and software architect who launched handweaving.net in 2004, just a year after learning to weave. The site includes a wide and growing variety of digital tools for weavers, as well as documents related to a variety of fiber arts. So Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, your site is called handweaving.net, and boy, that pretty much sounds like it covers everything. What is it that you do there?
Well, the site started as a simple draft archive, just with about 200 drafts, and grew over the years, and now there are more than 75,000.
75,000?
Yep.
Wow.
A lot of them are from old historic sources. Not everything. There's some new ones too, but it's a large, extensive collection, and the site has weaving tools so the drafts can be made to be interactive. You can do things with them. You can color them. You can edit them now. You can create what are called amalgamations from them, a kind of a reformation of the draft in a checkerboard pattern. And the site has old documents too. There was a professor of computer science at the University of Arizona named Ralph Griswold, and he created a pretty extensive archive on, you know, weaving, textiles, lace, and other related topics. And that's all available through handweaving.net too as well. In fact, a lot of those documents are where the drafts kind of got their start. So they were published originally in those, and then later I made digital versions for the website. So it has all of those things.
You know, I've noticed that weaving software, or WIFS, which is the extension for a weaving information file, right? Mm-hmm. I've noticed that for some weavers, it's absolutely your go-to must-have for everything. I do find some people who are still not very familiar with it. How did you get into using WIFS?
Well, I bought an AVL loom, actually. It was a computerized loom, and it had a Dobby with it. And I needed a digital representation of the patterns to be able to run the Dobby. And WIF was kind of a universal format. It was intended to allow weaving patterns to be shared among different programs, because otherwise each program has its way of storing and loading. But if you wanted to give one to someone else who had a different program, you couldn't do that. So WIF appealed to me a lot because it is kind of universal. It's a really simple representation for patterns, but you can share them among different people in different programs. And I happened to use them for the AVL Dobby originally. I actually wrote software that drove my own Dobby that used WIF.
And the Dobby, it's not just a house elf. Is that the thing that lifts each individual thread?
Yeah, it will let you essentially set all of the shafts that get raised for a particular row, and then it'll raise them when you tell it to. So the Dobby on this loom could either be mechanical or computerized. It might happen to be computerized. And so instead of pushing treadles to raise the right shafts for each pick, you would just advance the pattern, and then the computer would raise the shafts for the next pick. So you can get really good complexity with that, because you can get like infinite tie-ups with it. I mean, it allows you to do things that are, in effect, have infinite treadles. So you can weave patterns that are much more complex than if you had, you know, 10 or 12 treadles and you tie them up a certain way and that's all you got. So
I'm picturing tap dancing with all these different treadles.
No, the computer does a lot. It's pretty easy if you got a computerized one.
But people who are working with even like 4 and 8 shaft looms tend to reach for WIFS if they want to make changes, right?
Yeah, the WIF, think of it as just a way to get a pattern. It has nothing to do with how simple or complex your loom is. So you can use WIF with two shafts if you want. You can use it with 60, whatever you got. I mean, it's just a way to get and store patterns.
And some of what handweaving.net is doing, from what you said, is that you can actually manipulate them. So it's not just opening something up as you would a PDF. It's that you can make changes and transform something and tweak it in your computer versus having to try it out.
Yeah, the website has the capability to just download them like PDFs or use them on the screen without even realizing they're WIFs. But you can also interactively change them. It's got three or four tools, and more are planned, but three or four right now that will let you do that. One of them is the color editor. So if you want to try on new colors for size, you can do that. And you can do it from a picture too. So you can upload a picture or capture one with your mobile phone's camera, and you can instantly color a draft from that. So if you're in a yarn shop and you're looking at yarns on a shelf and you think, oh, I want to weave something with that, and I have a draft in mind, you can go to the site on your phone, take a picture of the yarn and see what it would actually look like. So that's pretty cool. And there is also now a new draft editor, which will let you create patterns from scratch or edit the ones already on the site. So you can, it's basic weaving software. So you can do things like, you know, fix the tie up, set it however you want, add shafts, add treadles, remove or add shafts or treadles. Same with threads, warp threads, weft threads. You can add and remove, set them how you want. You can copy and paste too. So it makes it really easy to create an entire pattern from scratch and see how it's going to look. And you can color it all in one spot.
That's so interesting, because I think color is one of the things that is so important in weaving that it can be really not intuitive. You can think you are going to know what these two colors are going to look like, but then when you interlace them, there are always surprises, or often surprises.
Yeah, there can be. Some patterns, the color is just kind of the background color or the foreground color. But in other patterns, the color and weave, the visual motif is actually formed by how the threads interlace with different colors. And those are really interesting. And you're right. Sometimes colors can look together good on a shelf or not so good when they're on a shelf in the yarn shop. But then when you actually see them in the yarn and how it interlaces and then how the fabric folds later, the effect can be pretty different. So.
Do you sometimes find it as much fun to play with the possibilities in their digital form as to actually watch it interlace and thread?
I do. I'm a computer geek first and foremost. So, I've been writing and designing software for my whole professional life. And sometimes when I'm making these tools, I'll have to pull myself back because I'll start, enough of it will be done to use. And I'll start testing and then it's fun. And then I realize, oh, wait a minute, time's getting away. And I should be probably finishing this and moving on to something else rather than playing with it. So yes.
So this project is kind of a busman's holiday for you. It's kind of like the personal version of what you do for a living.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like work. I mean, I love doing this so much. So it's awesome.
And aside from it really integrating with the rest of your site, what was it that made you want to include the kind of weaving software program elements in handweaving.net that you can find elsewhere?
Well, for many years, the site did not have those. And then I was approached by Tian Chu. She's a weaving teacher. She was teaching a workshop on color. Mm-hmm. And she wanted some tools to use in her workshop so that the students didn't necessarily have to go buy or download or install weaving software. They could just go to a website and use that. And she asked if I could do color. And at first I thought, I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can get that to be fast enough, honestly. But she pushed a little bit. And so I agreed to do it like a preliminary version. And I tried it and it worked really well. It took a lot of work. It was not easy to make a website edit weaving patterns, color and other aspects like regular software. That's not easy at all, but it does work and it's really fast. And you don't have to have any kind of special device, whatever you've got, a tablet, an iPad, it doesn't matter. It'll work. So Tian, I think I will credit her with the idea that things could be interactive. And I think I even told her no at first. I'm like, I don't think that's possible. But when then I started working on it, and sure enough, it was not only possible, it was awesome. So that led from one thing to another. I have a profile and block drafting feature that was the next thing that was interactive. And if I hadn't done the color thing, I don't think I would have tried that because it's more aggressive in terms of what it requires from a computer and just the programming for it and the processing power.
Why is that?
Just there's a lot more math involved. When you expand a profile draft, you're essentially, it's like matrix algebra, where one little cell in the matrix becomes a whole grid in the final thing. So it's like, I want to call it matrix either composition or expansion. It's both, really. But there's a lot of math behind that. And that, when you make a change, has to happen really, really fast, or a web browser won't update itself and it'll time out and you'll get error messages. And it just, in regular software programming, it's also a lot of work, but you have more processing power in theory, because on the web, you don't know what kind of device you have. It could be a really not powerful phone. It could be a super old iPad. It could be a Windows machine that's mid-range or super powerful, or maybe it's a dinosaur, but you just don't know. And it's got to work pretty well on maybe not all of them, but almost all of them. Like that, if it doesn't, then you didn't hit the mark. So that was my hesitation. Like, could I actually make that work on everything? And pretty much, yes, with a lot of careful design and some work. But
is the complexity in part because they're now, you know, measuring colors on screens in the millions?
That part's actually pretty easy. Those are just extra numbers. It's more, think about what you have to do if you're going to take a draft and change something in it. You have to pretty much update the whole thing. So if you change one cell in the tie-up, it changes everything. It doesn't change the threading or the trailing, but it completely changes the drawdown. So you have to recompute the whole thing, or you have to figure out which part changed and just recompute that, and then redraw it. And then to be able to have different sizes for different screens and scale it, all of that, when you see it as a human, it's super simple. It's like, oh yeah, that's just a draft. But then when you think about all the things that have to happen behind the scenes to make it work, that's when it becomes complex. And it's a really cool problem. It's fun to work on. So
that is one of the things about this, is that if you do it right, people don't even know what's
they have
behind
no idea.
And they don't have to understand, you know, why it works or even what you're solving in order for it to be helpful.
Yeah, so that's kind of my playground. I know what's behind it, and it's super fun. And there are some people who use the site who are also software developers, and they're well aware of what it takes. But then the average person coming to use it doesn't need to know, and that's a beautiful thing. Like, why should someone editing a weaving pattern or looking at one have to think about any of that? So I've tried to make, for the average user, the site should be super simple to use, and it should just work. And if you want to know how all that works, I'm happy to tell you. But if you don't care, that's even better. Like, it'll just work for you. It's kind of like when you buy a car. I mean, I'm not a car person.
I was going to say, don't put me on the spot. You'd have to teach me very basics. But, you know, one of the things my husband is an electrical engineer and absolutely, you know, loves all sorts of digital stuff. And we were watching a program about Claude Shannon, who was called the father of information theory, mm-hmm. who talked about, you know, essentially how you could describe everything binary. And he and his wife were weavers. His wife was active in the guild in Boston.
That doesn't surprise me.
Weaving really is everywhere.
Well, weaving for me, it's so amazing. I mean, it combines everything that I love. I love patterns. I always have. I find patterns in everything, even like pizza topping. I'll say, oh yeah, that's a, yeah. But then it's got history. I've always loved old historical things because I think they're great lessons for the future. And it's really fascinating to find out what people who came before me did and how they did things. And so there's that if you want it. It's art, it's beauty, like everything that I love. And there's math. There are a ton of math, and I love math. And well, there can be. That's the thing. You don't have to focus on that. But if you are like I am, it's there, and you can make that work to your advantage. Like, try to expand a profile draft in software without understanding some math. All that stuff is there, but it's really cool because you can enjoy it and use it, or you can kind of ignore a lot of it if you don't care about it either. And that's fine. I mean, you can just weave something beautiful and you don't have to understand all the math or the theory, but if you want to, it's there. So it's, to me, just the most beautiful combination of the things, and computer science too. Like, you can write software to do all this. So.
And then at the same time, you have to pair it with something that's physical. So, you know, you can make this beautiful draft, and if you don't get your tension right — my tension is never right — then all of a sudden it's a different experience.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, there's an art to it too, and the technique, and that's why people teach weaving. If you're going to make the physical goods after you make the digital ones, you have to know a lot and practice a lot and improve and get good. And it's not easy, but it sure is satisfying.
When I was working through your site, because I don't use weaving software, I love rigid heddle weaving, but I really appreciate the breadth of what's available. And what I've stumbled across was a lot of the historical materials. And looking in your index, I wound up with knitting and tatting, and then there would be other weave structures as well. And they were all kind of included on this one site.
Mm-hmm. The document section that we have has a lot of different topics in it. Like I said, most of those came from Ralph Griswold. Not all of them. There have been many contributed since Ralph, but a lot of them came from him, and he kind of picked what those would be. And he didn't have a particular bias toward weaving. I think he liked weaving a lot, but he explored knitting, padding, silks, like you name it. If it's textile related, he would get the books and scan them. So that's why we have so many different things.
Tell me a little bit about Ralph, because it sounds like there've been a couple of different, you know, partnerships and collaborations that have really made this site go, and he was one of them.
Yeah, when I first started the site, I had just gotten the AVL loom, and I was in the process of learning to weave. I wasn't very good at it, and I'm still not great, but that's okay. But when it was a computerized loom, I realized that with the WIF format, there was a way to represent drafts essentially as digital patterns. And so I hand entered a bunch, and then I started looking for old books or old resources, old places to get more. And Ralph's collection came up naturally because it was probably the biggest one on the internet at the time. So things were just at my fingertips. So I actually sent him an email just cold out of the blue. Hey, I'm Chris, and I've been using this, and here's what I'm using it for. And is that okay? And do you have more? And we kind of hit it off, and we worked together for several years. He passed away, sadly, but we worked together until that happened. And he was very supportive. And my site's a little bit different than his. I have all the documents from his site now available, including a really good search. But the focus of mine was taking those documents and then making digital representations of the drafts within them and putting those online. So I wrote specialized software that would take the pictures in those old digital documents and from the pictures generate modern weaving drafts. So you can essentially think of the pages in those documents each as an image. And the image would have a picture of drafts in various formats. Over the years, lots of different formats were used. But in the industrial age, like late 1800s, it was really common to just have the drawdown and nothing else. And then you were expected to take that and make a draft from it. And the simplest way is just to find a single unit of the pattern and then put a straight threading and straight treadling in. So my first software to produce drafts worked that way. It would take images and it would treat them kind of like OCR, like when you're scanning a document and turning the picture into text. Only my software would scan it and turn the picture into a weaving pattern. So it would go through and find the drawdowns, and then it would find a single unit of the pattern within. And then it would start making a draft by just applying, by taking that single unit of the pattern, turning it 90 degrees, putting it in as the tie up, and then adding a single, like a straight threading and a straight treadling. And that would make a weaving draft that would weave that fabric. But then you can process it more. You can actually look for repeated columns or rows in the tie-up. And if you find those, then you can make the treadling and threading not straight anymore. And you can alter the tie-up so that there's only one instance of each column or each row. And that'll produce a more compact draft, so more people could weave it. So the software does a lot of stuff like that. After it finds the patterns in the pictures of the old book pages, it will make the simplest pattern that it can. And the thinking behind that is that more people could weave it that way. And you can always expand it to be straight or point or have a beautiful threading if you want to, but you don't need to. If you have a loom that, you know, maybe you've only got six shafts or whatever, and the pattern can be compacted to be woven that way, even if the tie-up isn't nice and straight, or the threading or treadling aren't nice and straight anymore, you can do that. So
it's kind of unlocking the potential of these, they're sort of records. It's sort of an archive, and bringing it kind of to life.
Yes, very much so. I have books, some from old museums that are in quill pen, and I adapted the software over the years to be able to read that too. So it can actually do a pretty decent job of reading a threading written in quill pen or reading a tie-up written that way. And sometimes that was a very hard problem to solve. They're not even there. Sometimes mistakes are just blotted out because they couldn't erase. So in a bad case, they would just cross it out and use a new page in the book. But sometimes they would sort of try to fix it. And so some error corrections required, but what I have is modern representations of these drafts, per your question, that were written in really old works in all kinds of different formats and notational styles. So if you get one off of the website, off of handweaving.net, it will be a modern draft, just like you'd expect to see, you know, in Handwoven magazine or anywhere else or a book, or it'll have the tie-up, the treadling, the threading, all the common parts like you would expect. But in these old books, they didn't necessarily have all those, or they were written in ways that aren't standard today that you would have to understand to be able to interpret.
And there's so much regional variation too. I mean, there's cultural variation, regional variation. You have drafts from different languages and at a time when people were really learning to weave locally as opposed to communicating across the world.
Yeah, the internet didn't exist at that point. So knowledge was not as widely distributed as it is now, or moved more slowly. Maybe that's a better way to put it, I think. Yeah, there are all sorts of different styles in these old books, and sometimes I've needed help from others to be able to understand them. Some of the books, many of them are not written in English, or they don't have any words at all. So
that would almost be easier.
Well, on some level, yeah, it doesn't really. If the words are explanatory texts that refer to how to interpret the draft or how to work with it, then they're very important. But other sorts of information, draft notation, it's kind of universal. You don't really have to speak a particular language if you understand how it works. And so to varying degrees, being able to read the text is important.
Do you work with, you know, historical museums at this point? Or how do these things make it into your collection?
So sometimes a lot of museums lately have been putting certain documents online for all to use. And that's awesome when it happens. Not all museums do that. And sometimes I've had several museums just contact me and say, we have this, it's in our collection, it's special. Would you like to put it on the website? And that's amazing when that happens. Usually there's some person who's particularly interested who will, you know, have one of these special things, and then they'll find my site or they'll find me and contact me. It doesn't happen all that often, but every year or two, at least once, I'll get a contact like that. And sometimes someone will have an old work in their private collection, a copy of it. And if it's public domain or if the copyright holder can be reached, sometimes we can include those. It just depends on, you know, the nature of this, whatever it is in the particular scenario. But I also have a very large collection of works that have been contributed that I haven't had time to process. There are hundreds of them just sitting, waiting that if I ever get time, they'll be included. So there's a big backlog right now. And every time I have time to work on content, I'll go through that and try to pick the one that seems like the most valuable to get included at that time. So my time is divided between a regular day job, a family, and then the time that's working on the website. It's either working on new features like the weaving tools that have come lately, or it's working on content.
Is that content part something that people can join in?
Sometimes that's happened, yeah. If people want to make drafts or they've already got drafts for particular work that we want to include, then absolutely. And that's wonderful when it happens. It doesn't happen that often, but it's a pretty amazing thing when it does, because it saves me a lot of work and it lets someone else participate. And the website's structured right now so that anybody can upload drafts that they have produced. They go into a common collection, but if they're going to go into a special one that's dedicated to a particular book or old work, then I have to help with that right now. So if they contact me, they can contribute, you know, all the drafts for a book they've produced or something like that. And then it will go into a special collection dedicated to that work on the website directly.
You mentioned that Ralph Griswold died in 2006. When did you start handweaving.net? Because 2006 is already a respectable age for a website.
Yeah,
you must have had this going for a couple of years before that.
2004, I believe, either late 3 or early 4, somewhere in there. Yeah. Yeah. It's been going for a while.
And it seems like have there been different phases of it? How has it grown over time?
Well, let me think about that. So when it first started, it was like fledgling, you know, 200 drafts. I had entered them all by hand. And then I'd say the next phase was writing software that would produce drafts from pictures of old works. So that was a few years long. You know, it took a year or two to write that. It took a long time to write that. That was one of the more complicated things that I've ever written. And it's been modified over the years. But from that, I would say the next, I don't know, 6 or 8 years were spent just digitizing as many things as possible and then adding those to the site and adding a few features. And then the next years after that, the site received a couple of really major rewrites. It was done early using Microsoft technologies, and now it uses almost none of those. But it's done using all kind of modern web technologies. And then a site like this probably has to be rewritten every 3 to 5 years, just either rewritten or substantially revised, because technologies change, devices change, and if it's going to be a truly professional world-class site, you just have to do that. And if you don't, you'll fall behind and eventually it'll become obsolete or not maintainable. And so that's kind of a common theme over time. So I guess the next major thing that I did was to rewrite it from the initial technologies to use ones that were more scalable. And then that's been done twice since then, including once about 3 months ago. So
now it's interesting to have as the goal to have a professional world-class site,
yeah,
as opposed to something that you start just as a, I've found this cool thing that I like, would you like to share it with me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What made you decide that was a good goal?
Well, I've designed, you know, kind of world-class professional software for a living. I've done that for many years, and I can't imagine doing it any other way. When the site first started, it wasn't anywhere near as good as it is now, but it's improved substantially. And I just thought, if I'm going to put all this time into this, it better be amazing. It better be the best thing I can make, or why do it? Like, let someone else do it at that point. I mean, it's also a lot of programmers have kind of pet projects that they use to develop and enhance their skills over time. You know, things, if you're trying to learn new technologies, or people write code all the time and they throw it away. Well, I don't do that. I actually, it's kind of my playground too. If I want to try something new or learn something new, I always think of a way to tie this in so that it will benefit at the same time. And then instead of throwing the learning work away, it goes into the site. So it benefits me, my professional career, as well as the people using the site.
And I suppose one of the changes is that people use this on all different kinds of technology, right? Because in 2004, there weren't smartphones, for example, or tablets. So the architecture around you changes all the time.
Yeah, in 2004, the question was, do you have a Windows computer or do you have a Mac? I mean, that was it.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, do you have an iPad? Do you have an Android tablet? Is it an iPhone? Is it that Windows computer? Are you using Linux? Do you have a Mac? Which kind? There's like just an infinite number of devices and permutations. But one of the substantial rewrites during the last few phases of the site's updates were to make it work with nearly any device. That was about 8 or 9 years ago. And that has to be continually redone to be current. I mean, the devices change and the way that they represent things change. Now, super high resolution devices are coming out, and there's some stuff you have to do to a website to make that look good, because you can't have, you know, if you've got 8,000 pixels across, you can't have the website be this little teeny square up in the upper left hand corner, because that's all it, you know. So there's continual work necessary to make it compatible with all devices on an ongoing basis. New things come out, and it's not a lot of work anymore because it's been designed with that in mind. But when I first did it, it was an immense amount of work to try to make something that would work and look good on a phone, or work and look good on a huge screen like I have here. Like, it was just, that was a challenge, but it works and does. It works well.
And once again, if you do it right, people never know what goes into it.
I'm sure no one ever thinks about that. I mean, I don't when I use it, unless I pay attention to it. It's just like, oh yeah, I've got my wife's iPad. That works fine. Or I've got my computer at work and it's a wall size display. That works fine. Or, hey, I'm on the bus and I got my phone. That, you know, and that's the way it should be. You should be able to grab any device, go anywhere. I mean, that technology should be freeing. And so you shouldn't have to think about, oh, that site won't work with that. It just should.
Well, it's interesting what you said about technology should be free, because there's different meanings of free.
No, I meant for freeing. It should be something where it enables you to go places and do things that you couldn't do before.
Yes. Well, but there are different meanings of free, I mean, you know, available to access. And one of the things about handweaving.net is that up until this point, a lot of this has just been generally available, which I would think would make it hard to invest the kind of time and resources in it that it would need to make it a world-class professional website.
Yeah. So the site for many years was completely free. My wife and I financed it, and we got donations, and we had a web store that sold CDs and things, but we never made very much off of that. And so it was enough to keep it going for a while. But then I would say around 2007 or 8, it got really popular and it got discovered, and we started having many thousands of users instead of hundreds, and it got really expensive to offer. And we got more donations, and a lot of really generous people helped us, and we kept it going. But about 4 or 5 years ago, we got to the point where it was costing a huge amount of money, and we had a choice to make. It was like, we could either shut it down, we could run it on a really small scale and only let a few people in, or we could charge a small fee and try to make it as good and as big and keep going like we had been. And we chose the latter. And it was controversial at the time. Not everybody likes to pay for things, and especially something that's been free all along, but we don't charge very much. So we have an annual subscription system, or monthly, where you can pay either once a year or once a month, a smaller amount. And that enables us to keep it running. We still get some donations and we still have the web store, but the subscription system is really what's enabled this to survive. Like, we would have had to close it. It was just costing so much that it, as a family, it wasn't feasible to finance it ourselves. But it's popular enough and people see enough value in it that we're able to keep going. And I'm thankful for that every day. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So
one of the things that I think people don't necessarily realize is the difference between, you know, just your home internet subscription and what it takes to maintain a website, all the different elements to it, server space, connection time, all of those different, I don't know that I'm using the right words, but every, you know, all of these different web infrastructure and digital sharing elements have their own costs associated with them.
It is not cheap to run this at all. It uses Amazon Web Services, a very modern cloud services architecture, and there are a whole bunch of things underneath that it uses. And that stuff, it's amazing. It lets you have something that you would have had to be a huge company to have 10 or 15 years ago. So, you know, a small thing like this can be done on a world-class basis, but it has some world-class prices underneath it we have to pay every month. So that's why I'm continually thankful that people subscribe and support it, because it we can keep going and we can do that, you know. and what you have to pay isn't very much. And it's so amazing that we have enough people supporting us that we can keep doing this.
We found ourselves in a similar boat, you know, as a media company. And I think subscriptions and subscription fees are a lot more common and expected for things like magazines. But that kind of ongoing support and, you know, the ability to use that to launch other products or offerings or try out something new with that sort of crowd support, it's kind of like, I think, you know, Patreon has come along in the last 10 years or so, and it's a little bit different, but, you know, being able to really be part of what you're using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of our users or our site visitors, I like to think of them as visitors rather than users. I've always hated that term, but the people who use the site, some of them actually contribute ideas and things directly, and others just support us through subscribing. But either one's really beneficial. They are actually part of making this go forward. And without people doing those things, it wouldn't. I mean, it costs enough to run this that we have to have support or we couldn't. So we don't have any private support. We don't have a, you know, large benefactor, university grants, none of that. So this is how it works. And I'm glad that it does.
And it's become this interesting sort of meeting place. I noticed that, for example, when I was going through, you have some drafts related to the chorus effect, which I talked to Amy Norris about a few episodes ago. And, you know, when you think about overshot and these techniques that are very old, you don't necessarily think about Amy and Margaret developed this sort of effect or way of describing an effect, and people can come and play with it on your site in a way.
There are some drafts that have the chorus effect in them right now that Margaret and Amy have contributed. And I haven't talked to Margaret about this yet, but I'm thinking about making something so people could produce those drafts on the site. I have to learn more about how it works first, but we did a similar thing with Alice Schlein's amalgamations recently. There's a technique called amalgamation, and Alice did a lot of work to help develop that. And this to me is somewhat similar. Like, Margaret and Amy have done a lot of work to develop this special way of applying or using color to get really cool effects and patterns. And maybe I could make a tool that would allow people to do that interactively online. That'd be cool. So, like I say, I have not talked with them about this yet, and it's an idea I'm kicking around in my head, but at some point that may become a reality.
So you've talked about all the different elements and capabilities that you've added over time. So what are you working on next?
At the immediate moment, I'm working on finishing the draft editing stuff that we talked about a little bit earlier. That's actually not released as of today, but it will be very soon. And that will let you create and modify existing patterns, the structures of the patterns, in addition to just the colors. So that's the first thing. And I've just finished making another new feature that's also not yet announced that will let you share things among the various weaving tools on the site without having to download them in between. So let's say you made something using the amalgamation editor that we talked about, or maybe you used the profile expansion thing and came up with a neat draft, and now you want to color it. Or maybe you want to change the type a little bit because you like what you got, but you could bring that into the two different editors that do those things with just a click of a button. So that exists now. That's a new feature that just got made. And also, I probably will make some features where, now that you can create drafts so easily on the site yourself or modify them, I have some features in mind where if you make something you really love, you can publish it with just a click. You could share it with everybody else on the site. So right now, to publish it, you have to download the file, and then you have to upload it. But I'm going to make something that'll skip that step. So if you made something awesome, you can say, yes, I want to share this with everyone else. And with one click, you can do that. And some other improvements, the areas of the site where you contribute drafts right now, I want to make them a lot more personalized. So it's something that you upload or contribute, you have editorial control over it, essentially. So you'll be able to see everything that you've contributed in the past where it's named, what the pattern numbers are, things like that. And maybe if there's something with a mistake, you could unpublish it and fix it, or think, you know, things now that I'm getting emails, hey, I need help with this. Every time I get an email like that, I keep a list and I think, okay, this person probably wouldn't have needed to write to me if the site could just do that. So I have a big long list of improvements like that to make. And I guess another kind of theme area that I'd like to explore is a little more social aspect to the site. Maybe I don't really want it to be like the Facebook of weaving. That's not my dream, I don't think. But I do want it to have more social features. So when people come and they discover really cool things, or they make things that are awesome, they can share with other people easily. So I have some features in mind that will help facilitate that better than it's done now. So right now, people actually use Facebook to share things that they find or they make on the site. And there's a really awesome group called Projects from Handweaving.net. And a friend of mine, Karen Harmon, started that group. And so it's not even something I started. It was her idea. And she wrote to me one day and said, hey, I'd like to make this. And I thought, why not? That sounds cool. And it's got over 4,000 people in it right now. And people share projects that they've woven from the site every day. And anybody who's visited the site can join the group. So it's not exclusive, but you need to have visited the site and answer a couple of really basic membership questions, and then you can join. And that's to keep out spammers and other people who aren't, you know, contributors to a community like that. So
yeah, that's challenging, because if it's something that you create, you get to sort of, you know, design the world and say what it is. But that's a lot of work if you want to satisfy all of what people want to share. So having a way of integrating that. Do you envision it being a forum, or how do you?
Probably different areas. They're probably, I don't know if I want to let people follow other people, but that would be one area. If you could follow other people, then you could see, oh, this person contributed a pattern, or this person downloaded or wove this particular pattern, or things like that. Or they've just found something cool, or they tagged a pattern. Tagging is a way to categorize a pattern. Then the visitors to the site can help other people find stuff if they tag patterns. So there probably are some controlled ways to let people share who want to their activity with other people to help things be located and to help people use the site and get the most out of it. So I need to put some thought into that. I don't want to just open it up kind of like Facebook, where it's a total social network, because that's not really the focus of the site. But I do think that if it had more social features, people would get more from it and be able to use it better and help other people find things.
Do you actually get to spend any time weaving?
Not as much as I would like. A little bit. I'm actually between looms right now. I have sold both of the looms that I had, and I'm looking for something else. So at the immediate moment, I'm not weaving at all.
Wow.
But I'm hoping to fix that. My dream is to get something. I love complex patterns. So something with a lot of shafts. And the AVL that I had was just, that was a magical loom. It was wonderful. But it was a 60-inch production Dobby loom. It had a double fly shuttle, and it had a, I think it had a 2-yard beam. It had a big sectional beam on the back, and it was a massive though. It took an entire room. I mean, this was a big, big loom. So I wove tablecloths, blankets, things that were, you know, the full 60 inches wide every time, because I just couldn't resist threading the whole thing. And
yeah.
So at this point though, my wife and I are downsizing a little bit. We got kids who are moving out. At some point, I'll probably get something smaller, but I'd love it if it had 40 shafts, or, you know, 32 at least, just something big for complexity, big in terms of shafts.
Now, given the fact that there's so much historical elements on your site, and we're talking about being able to raise and lower individual shafts, the thing that makes me think of is a Jacquard loom, which is obviously a very different kind of a technology. Mm-hmm. Are you curious about that at all?
Yeah, Jacquard looms are fascinating. I don't know if I'll ever own one.
Well, anybody does.
Well, I could. I mean, I could get a TC1. There are a lot of Jacquards that are, not a lot, but it's something that if you want, it's attainable. But I like the shaft patterns, just traditional regular weaving, a lot. And I guess I've been working with patterns that are this style for so long, and people get trapped by complexity. Complexity is wonderful. And I fall into the same trap. You know, you want something that can weave like infinite varieties and huge numbers of shafts and all this stuff. But then sometimes when you look at what you can do with just 2 or 4, it's also amazing. And I realize, oh yeah, I'm chasing 16 or 32 or however many shafts. And that's fun. I like that. But if I only had 2 or 4, there's so much that I could do that I haven't even explored yet that it really wouldn't matter. I think I'd be just as happy and do things that are just as amazing. They'd just be different.
I was given a tour of the weaving village at the Henry Ford Museum. Mm-hmm. And they have, I'm not sure if it's technically a Jacquard, but it's a card powered loom. And one of the things I learned there was that if you don't have the set that makes the cards, and if you don't have the set that goes with the loom, you've essentially lost the ability to program that loom.
Yeah. Wow.
which is just amazing. And it's all of these, it looks like a Jacob's ladder, all of these cards kind of going down and making these designs, but
that's somewhat true with all Dobby looms as well. If you think about a Dobby is a really specialized piece of hardware. The manufacturers of the looms have to make these things, and then software providers have to support them. And that, I mean, this is not a huge industry. So I would say every loom manufacturer is kind of hanging by a thread. Like, we are so lucky to have the ones that we do. And I mentioned AVL a few times. There are other ones too, but like, we should not take this for granted, because this isn't an industry where you get rich. This is an industry where it's truly a labor of love, and you better love it. And you need enough customers to survive. And that's kind of the bar.
I was talking to the folks at Webs, and I think that the initial owners of Webs, when they sell one of their looms, they still go out and put it together.
Yeah.
And the editor of Handwoven, Susan Horton, I believe she still has an AVL. And part of the reason she bought an AVL was that she lives in Southern California.
Yeah.
And if she ran into problems, she wanted to know that she would be able to get somebody.
Yeah, that's important. It really is. We are very lucky to have the loom manufacturers that we do. It's not an easy business to be in. And the ones that have survived are good, and they're really good, all of them. And we're fortunate.
So if I were a weaver who had a fairly standard 4-8 shaft loom with 6 or 12 treadles, what would I be likely to do if I came to handweaving.net? Like, what sort of features do you think that I would use most?
Well, depends on what your interests are, but probably just start with looking through the draft collections that we have to see what you can find. There are 12 or 15 ways to search for drafts on the site. There are a ton of different ways. And if you wanted to find only things that you could weave on your loom, there's a way to configure a filter that will follow you around so that when you search for things, it only shows things that are workable on your loom. So if you said, hey, I've got 6 shafts and I've got 8 treadles or whatever it is, you could put all that in. And you can also configure filters for floats. So let's say you're weaving baby blankets. And if you configure the filters, then as you browse the site and you look through all these 75,000 drafts, you don't actually see all 75,000. You see just the ones that you could weave, which will help narrow down results that are interesting for you. So I guess to answer your question, if I came to the site for the first time and I had a loom like that, I'd probably spend a little bit of time perusing the drafts just to see what was there. There's a help link we have a YouTube channel that's got tutorials for all the major areas on the site, and they're intentionally short, simple, and succinct. So you can, if you want to know how to do a particular thing, you can watch a video and it'll show you just that. I would spend a little bit of time doing that if I found the site interesting, just to get more familiar with all the things that it offers. And then I go back and play with the drafts some more. And then maybe start looking at documents after that.
And you could, you know, take your camera over to your wall and try one of the yarns that you already have in your stash, or head over to the yarn store and plug in something. If you had like a few different structures you wanted to try out, you could plug in your yarn and see what you would get.
Yeah, you could, if you want to try the colors on for size, you could find a draft that you like. Hey, I think I want to weave that. And then you could take a picture of your stash or go to a yarn store or something like that, and then start picking colors to see what works. Yep.
Do you think that most of the users of handweaving.net at this point are more complex weavers, or do you think it's kind of a broad range?
We have an incredibly broad range. We have people weaving amazing things with huge numbers of shafts, and we have people weaving 2-shaft patterns on, you know, rigid heddle looms, and you know, it's all over the map. We have people from complete beginners through super advanced, and I don't know. We probably should do a survey at some point to try to figure that out, but I don't have a, you know, numerical answer. Here's a histogram that shows exactly how many people come and how many people are beginner, mid, advanced. But I do know that there's people from all walks of life and people from all backgrounds and with a very wide range of capabilities and skills. We have some people who are elderly, like there are people in their 90s using the site, and they're weaving things from it. And that's amazing to me. Like, and I hear from them, and that makes me happy. Like, I hope when I'm 90, I'm still doing stuff like that.
It's interesting that you mentioned rigid heddle. I hadn't been sure if that would be, if that would relate, but you know, one of the things Susan Horton has talked to me about is maybe we should talk about why weaving software can be useful for rigid heddle weavers. Because on one hand, we talk about how, well, there's 2 shafts, you go up and down, and you can only do up, down, up, down, up, down. And then on the other hand, we talk about how with a pickup stick, you can get all kinds of different variety. So how do rigid heddle weavers use your site?
Well, there are actually some documents on adapting traditional weaving patterns for rigid heddle use. And I didn't create these, but I found them. So typically what happens is I'll get an email that says, hey, I've got a rigid head of loom. I'm thinking about signing up, or I already signed up, or I have some interest. Can the things on your site be used with that? And I usually just mail them one of these documents and I say, we don't have patterns that are for rigid head specifically, but many of the patterns there can be adapted to work that way. And here's some instructions from other people who've done this, and here's how it works.
There are people doing just the wide range of, you know, everything from lace floats, you know, 3-1 lace or something like that, up to, I want to weave these incredible pinwheels on a rigid head of loom.
I can't imagine that, but I know, I don't know if I have the patience or the to get that right and to be happy about it the whole time. But table looms amaze me too. You'll get these people with these multi-shaft table looms. Some of them have 16, and that, you know, for every single pick, they have to flip the levers and get everything lined up and then weave that thread in and then do another one. And just, I've seen some of the most intricate, amazing things woven from the site on table looms that don't have treadles, you know, and there's no tie up. And you just, we have a special mode where you can say, show me a lift plan view. So it's essentially, instead of the tie up, it takes the tie up off the pattern, and then where the treadling would be, the weft threads, it puts in a column of how the shafts look for every single pick in the pattern.
Wow.
So with that, you could sit there with a table loom and go, okay, so I'm on pick, you know, 13, I've got to raise these and lower these. And now I'm on pick 14 and I got to raise these and lower these. So you go flip all the levers. And I've seen people take 16 shaft patterns and weave the most intricate, beautiful things and get it right. Like no mistakes on a table loom. I can't imagine that. Like that takes some patience and skill both, but I do see it. Like it happens.
What about things like inkle and tablet weaving?
Are people using the site for those things too? I don't know as much about those, but I do believe that it's possible. It's probably like the rigid heddle where you have to figure out how to take a traditional pattern and adapt it. Huh. I mean, the patterns on a raw level are just patterns. And if you get rid of all the standard shaft loom stuff, then you're left with a pattern. And there's probably a way to represent it on lots of different looms if you know how.
Yeah, it really is that binary. It's up or down.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what it boils down to. And the question is, do you understand how to take that and adapt it to the system that the loom that you have in front of you works with?
I came into the fiber art, fiber craft world through the sort of the knitting groundswell in the late 90s and early 2000s. And since then, it's been really interesting to see how the audience has changed. And we've really noticed that weaving has sort of taken off. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah.
I know that your site has grown, but also in terms of the audience.
The audience is growing. Some younger people are getting involved. People's kids are interested in it. And the pandemic, for all the bad things, it did have some good things too. It made people stay home. And while they stayed home, they were looking for creative pursuits. And I think people discovered, at least the weaving world, a lot of people discovered how amazing it was and just how cool it is to make something with your hands still. How many people still do that? And I think it was a forced reawakening. So it wasn't all bad. A lot of it was certainly, but mm-hmm. you know, that particular aspect of it was good. It made people spend time together as families again. Mm-hmm. And it made people do creative things, not just weaving, but woodworking, all the things that you can do at home with your hands. People discovered a new joy for cooking. I watched our kids go from kind of digital nomads to being, you know, they weren't mobile either. Everybody was together for a while and they started doing art again, and they started being interested in things that weren't just on a screen. I'm certainly not biased against screens, obviously, but the reason I like them is because they help you extend and experience regular life better. It's not, the screen to me is not like it's a means to an end. It isn't the end.
Right. So at a time when everybody was sort of locked down at home, between mail order for your yarns and the information and education you could find online, you know, you could grow your craft from your own home.
Yeah. And the other thing that was good about it was people discovered that you didn't have to be physically next to someone to work with them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these guilds, workshops, presentations, and things moved to being online. And that to me isn't necessarily bad. I mean, it's certainly wonderful to be with other people, but at the same time, it's really wonderful to not need to be physically adjacent to other people. You can connect with so many more.
Yeah.
People in remote areas now have opportunities because things can be online and people have realized, oh, this is actually possible and it can work. And so it opens some opportunities. And travel in some ways it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of resources. And if you can share information with other people and not have to do that, that's sometimes a really good thing.
All you need is a really good internet connection.
Yeah.
Is that difficult to keep the footprint, the digital footprint of the site low? I mean, you've mentioned that there's a lot of calculations going on and you have to be careful not to time out, but there are still parts of the country where we wind up with people who can't download a video, who can't stream videos.
Yeah. So it is something I have to think about. The hosting provider, it's actually hosted through Amazon Web Services, and it's designed to be effectively infinitely scalable. So the site, unlike in previous years, you know, 15 years ago, if a lot of traffic came and I got 3,000 hits all at once because a lot of people were trying something, it would slow everybody else down. But that doesn't happen anymore. The way that it's hosted now, it will just grow infinitely because the back end is really carefully designed to do that. The other areas, the other layers, though, like the download speed that you mentioned, that can be a problem in some places. It's a lot better than it used to be. People used to have modems and really slow connectivity or none. And you know, that's a huge problem. But that's gotten better. And the site's also designed to be pretty low impact in terms of bandwidth. So if you're in a rural area and you don't have great internet, it might not be as fast as if you're in a big city, but it's still going to work and it's going to work pretty well. And that's very intentionally designed and it wasn't easy. There's some stuff, if I didn't have to care about that, there's a lot of other stuff that could be done with the site that would be really cool, but you'd exclude, you know, half your audience. So that's probably not a good thing right now, but every year it gets better. I mean, as bandwidth gets better, I add more. And
are you telling me that if we all had broadband, you could have like a weaving hologram come and help you with your, drafts?
You could have stuff that you don't have now. Yes. Mm-hmm. If we all had fiber to the door and broadband. Yes, absolutely. And there's some things that would be different, but it's kind of, I want it to be as good as it can be, but I also want it to include as many people as possible. So I could have different versions. You could have a high speed version, a low speed version, but I just honestly don't have time to make that. And it's not a very good design anyway. Generally, good websites will work for anyone in a kind of seamless way. And the person using it doesn't have to think about it. It'll just work and it'll work well. And you offer things that will do that.
Yeah.
That's my philosophy. I think that's how it should be.
I think so too, but it does really sort of put the pressure on you to be, you know, the man behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Makes everything go without showing.
And then some things are actually done with processing client side. And what that means is the user's own device will do the processing. Oh. And that scales really well because if there are 2,000 users, there are 2,000 devices. You know, if there's 10,000 users, there are 10,000 devices. So anything that I can process locally, I do. And that also requires some really careful programming because there are certain things that, like I said, happen at different layers. Some of it will happen in the Amazon cloud at the server side, and some of it will happen locally on the device. So then you combine the results, you know, to produce whatever the user's working with and seeing. And that all happens over the web, and there's all this stuff to think about. But it's a very fun problem to solve. But the people using the site have absolutely no idea. I mean, it's just like I'm working on a draft, and here's how it looks. And
Well, Chris, thank you so much for spending time. I'm really excited to go back and dig a little bit further into the site. So thanks for telling us a little bit about what goes on underneath.
Thanks for having me, and it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Visit handweaving.net to learn more about their digital tools and resources. Thanks to Treenway Silks and handweaving.net for sponsoring this episode. Thank you for listening to the Long Thread Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate the show and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again.